Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net.
I'm Dr. Marty Gentzius of Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, contributing editor Dr. Jeffrey Frieden speaks with Dr. Dwayne Rice of the University of Memphis regarding the practice of clinical hypnosis.
Good day, everybody. This is Dr. Jeffrey Frieden with the AudioSource.net. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Dwayne Rice, Associate Professor and Director of Counseling Programs for the University of Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. Rice has 20 years' experience as administrator in student personnel services. He's held office and served on numerous national and regional professional committees and organizations. Additionally, he's a licensed professional counselor in private practice. He's a certified fellow for the Board of Clinical Hypnotherapists. His extensive experience working in community agency counseling, especially in church-related and counseling settings, Dr. Rice's passion has continuously been student education. Today I'm talking with Dr. Rice about clinical hypnosis and hypnotherapy and what it means in a clinical setting and in a university setting. Good morning. How are you doing, Dr. Rice?
I'm fine. Glad to be here.
Good. Glad to have you today. Let's just start off from the beginning. Tell me a little bit about how you view the history of hypnosis to where it is today.
Okay. Well, it unfortunately had a rather rocky history. It was coined, the term was actually coined by a fellow named James Baird. It was prior to that, we date it back to Mesmer, which had some very probably unfortunate social reactions, and as well as professional reactions. Mesmer, we kind of danced to a different drummer.
Mesmerizing, if I recall.
Yes, yes. He had people dancing around pots of molten lead, and for some reason they didn't have the clothes on. He wasn't well received by the medical community.
That would attract a lot of interest, though, I'm sure.
Yes, it did. But hypnosis was utilized very heavily in World War One, particularly in the field. They didn't have anesthesia. You had to have a leg amputated. You needed to do something. Widely utilized, and then immediately after World War One, kind of was abandoned. One thing, stage hypnotist kind of caught on and gave it a bad name. Reemerged in World War Two for similar reasons, used for shell shock and those types of things. Fell from grace again. He's kind of been up and down. Milton Erickson is pretty well accepted as the father of hypnotherapy in America, and probably the vast majority of hypnotherapists in America would identify themselves as an Ericksonian hypnotherapist. 1950s is sort of started becoming more mainstream. APA and AMA, as well as for some reason the Roman Catholic Church, all embraced it as an appropriate medical procedure. And today, particularly with the emphasis on brief solution-focused therapy, it's regained some real popularity. It is the ultimate in brief solution-focused therapy.
The ultimate, okay. I am not trained in this field. I'm a licensed professional counselor. This has attracted me for the main reason. When I think of hypnotherapy, in my mind, I think of the Three Stooges, where they get hypnotized, and, you know, I am now in Alcatraz. We laugh about it, but that's what I think about hypnotism. And like you said before, sometimes it gets a bad rap with the magic shows and people doing things they wouldn't normally do. But we're taking this into a clinical setting where we want to help individuals that have serious problems. Not necessarily how does it work, but how do we apply it to a clinical setting, and how do we differentiate it from the entertainment section?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, TV and movies don't do us any favors. And one of the things, one of the ethical standards of certified clinical hypnotherapist, is you actually cannot do hypnosis for entertainment purposes. And I think that's a very good
statement. It specifically addresses that question.
Yeah. So trying to delineate that we are utilizing it as a therapeutic tool. And I guess my position on it, and thing I emphasize in my class to my students, it's not intended to in any way replace more traditional therapeutic approaches. It's just one more tool to have to augment your approach. In my private practice, I probably run 25% to 30% of what I do is hypnosis. The rest of it is what everybody else is doing. Probably the only reason it's that high is I get a lot of referrals from other therapists because I'm well known in the region as a mm-hmm. hypnotherapist. If it were just, well, in therapy, when do you all of a sudden decide, gee, I think hypnosis would be useful, it probably be less than 25%.
When would you make that decision? What is the factor that says clinical hypnosis is the tool I want to use now?
Well, it's just one more tool to have in your box of tools. The tools that I find extremely effective is there are techniques in hypnosis that are very good for any emotional state that you can identify an external trigger. For example, specific phobias, performance anxiety. I've even utilized it in agoraphobia, which is we think of it as being a little more generalized, but quite often with agoraphobia, if you really talk to them, you can start identifying a theme that, well, yeah, they seem to be somewhat unrelated, but they all are situations where the person feels trapped. So, okay, there's your external trigger. Anytime you can get something clearly identified, hypnosis is very effective. And when I say effective, I mean like, 2-3 sessions maximum, you can correct the problem. If it's a phobia, one session.
Are you changing their thinking, or are you looking to see what it is that's causing that phobia in hypnosis?
You're changing their emotional reaction to the trigger. Now, sorry, the good news and the bad news on hypnosis is that it is a quick fix. Obviously, because of that, it does not deal with the underlying issues. That's the thing I emphasize to my referrals. If, say, Dr. Smith refers somebody to me, they're having panic attacks. It's like, okay, panic attacks, bad thing. Mm-hmm. The symptom has become problematic enough that it makes sense to be, let's correct the symptom. So, correct the symptom. And the thing I really drive home is now you go back up the road and see Dr. Smith, you've got to deal with the underlying issue mm-hmm. that caused the panic in the first place, or it's going to manifest itself in some other way.
So I understand now that this is a tool for brief solution or brief focus therapy. It still doesn't address the underlying issue, which in any other case, the same thing happens. If you don't address the underlying issue, it manifests itself in another way. So this is one more tool to address it for immediate relief of a situation.
That's correct. And
how does it work like smoking, for example? I know smoking is the big thing for hypnosis because smoking is usually a lifelong habit for many people.
Yeah. Well, the two things that the layperson thinks of when they think of hypnosis for therapeutic purposes is smoking and weight loss. And I do both. I don't get passionate about those. I get very passionate about getting somebody to not have panic attacks. The other thing I use it heavily in is pain management. I get very passionate about this person has migraines. They're not going to have them tomorrow.
You're saying that clinical hypnosis is used to address migraine issues?
Oh, yes. Yes. If I could only... In fact, what got me into this area was... pain management. I have chronic pain myself. I have ankylosing spondylitis. And it is, if I could only utilize it for one thing, it would be hypnosis. Hypnosis for pain management. Now I kind of drifted there back to the smoking and weight management. It is effective in those areas. It's not as effective as it is for some of these other things. Research supports for smoking, you run somewhere around 20%, which is higher than any other program. But it's still 20%. That's not something I get real excited about, Now, I do have people that come to me to quit smoking, and like second session, they come back and say, gee, Doc, I don't even remember why I smoked in the first place. It's fantastic. And that's great. But I also have people who come back and say, well, yeah, I smoked a cigarette on the way home from your office. That's pretty demoralizing. But, Jeffrey, on the pain management part, for some reason, our unconscious mind takes everything literal. So, if you have somebody in a modest to deep trance, if you can take their pain and change it into a metaphor, change the metaphor, you change the pain. For example, somebody comes into my office and says, well, gee, Doc, I'm having these headaches. Well, describe it to me. Give me some visual descriptors. Well, gee, it's like I've got this crushing iron helmet on my head, and it's got spikes in it, and it's just, okay, that's great. I love those. Because all I've got to do, get him in trance, loosen the helmet, pull the spikes out. He comes out of trance, look, gee, his headache's gone. And it's just fantastic. Now, what you can't do is you can't do anything for the underlying physiological causes of pain. So, assuming this is chronic pain and I don't treat acute pain okay. Tells you something wrong. You need to go fix it. But if somebody's got chronic pain, such as arthritis, migraines, or something, then I work with them and do it rather effectively. The problem is the pain is going to come back. I see them three or four times, and you get a generalized effect in that you get that mind-body connection. The mind has bought into the idea of, gee, I can control this pain, and and the body's bought into that. So that has a powerful effect. But my ultimate goal is to train them in self-hypnosis. So when they feel the pain coming on, before they get this full-blown debilitating headache, they can get that under control. It's not a lot of value to have somebody where every time they're in pain, they got to run to my office.
So, like in the other things we do in counseling, it's an education type field. You're going to alleviate the pain initially, but then you're going to teach them how to do it themselves later on.
Yes, absolutely.
This reminds me of guided imagery, EMDR. How is this different from guided imagery and EMDR? How is this different?
Well, it's very similar to guided imagery. Hypnosis is really just in a relaxed state, a narrowing of the focus of attention in such a way to get in touch with the internal or unconscious self. That's a very empowering part of who you are. A lot of the techniques I use, such as the techniques I was talking about earlier for specific phobias, performance anxieties, things like that, they incorporate some type of guided imagery. Mm-hmm. You're in a movie theater viewing yourself in that situation. And in technique I'm thinking of, actually anchor on their forearm the desired emotional state they need to make that a more productive experience. Mm-hmm. As far as EMDR, probably not as much similarity. I'm certified in EMDR and do find it an effective tool for PTSD. I don't find it a cure-all. I don't think it can cure hangnails, even though some people use it for that. But one thing, Francine Shapiro, very adamant, this is not hypnosis.
Right.
And it really isn't.
As a clinician, but really uneducated in hypnosis, how then is it different? Because in the EMDR, I know there's hand movement or sometimes lights are used to have the eyes go back and forth. And in my mind, when I think of hypnosis, I always think of that dangling watch or that spinning spiral. I understand that I didn't take your class. So I know it's from TV. Well, I know for hypnosis. So you're still, and those, to me, they're both using apparatuses to put a person under a trance.
Yeah. Well, you can do hypnosis with the a watch or pendulum. Mm-hmm. Very few people actually use that technique anymore, and I don't use it. EMDR, the difference is whether you're using pendulum, eye fixation, or just talking somebody into trance, you are narrowing their focus of attention in order to get in touch with the unconscious self. EMDR, you're really not doing that. Mm-hmm. The way EMDR, we don't actually know how EMDR works, but the best theory on it, and the one I adhere to, is it's right brain, left brain chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in emotions are a right brain function. Cognitive, analytical skills are left brain functions. When you're in a high emotional state, whether it's anxiety, mad as hell, whatever's mm-hmm. going on, like 85% of the blood flows in the right hemisphere of the mm-hmm. brain. Well, you can't think clearly because right. you don't have any blood over there. That's why
the brain's accessing a different part of the cerebral cortex.
Correct. That's why we say and do such stupid things when we're angry. Is mm-hmm. that we don't have any blood in the left hemisphere of the brain.
And that can mean
this,
yeah.
Well, you know, the right hemisphere of the brain controls the left side of the body, vice mm-hmm. versa. Well, with the eye movement or the tappings or whatever you're using in EMDR, you're forcing yourself to use both sides of the body. Well, that levels out the blood flow. And then you do the visualization, and your brain's able to process that information in a more meaningful, productive way.
Okay. So you're forcing your brain, or rather, you're activating some parts of your brain that normally wouldn't be activated in a certain situation, such as in post-traumatic stress.
That is correct.
Okay. So then in hypnosis, then, what do you do? What's going on there?
Well, hypnosis, there is a technique. It's a VK dissociation technique that I teach in my class for PTSD that is very similar in that what you do is you get the person in trance. They do visualizations on movie screens of the traumatic event, once again, with the idea of they'll be able to process it in a more meaningful way. But in addition, there are some therapeutic things in it, such as your present self going and comforting your former self, reassuring your former self that you will survive. I'm living proof that you mm-hmm. survived, and reassuring them of things such as, you did the best you knew how to do at the time with the resources you had available, particularly if you're talking about childhood trauma.
Reality-based thinking then versus what if thinking.
Yes, yes, yes. And okay. And it's a very powerful, in fact, the technique quite often referred to as healing the inner child. It's a very powerful technique to bring closure to a traumatic event and to process that in a more meaningful way. The net results are the same or are very similar to EMDR. The mm-hmm. process is very different.
I see what you're saying.
And EMDR, really, as Francine Shapiro says, it is not hypnosis. I agree with
you. It's more of getting your brain working to full capacity versus hypnosis would be more reality-based thinking, what's really going on.
Yeah, that'd be one way of processing that.
That's interesting there. Well, you kind of answered my next question. My next question was, how does hypnosis work? So what you're saying is that you're transferring information based in reality. So going back to your pain management example with the person with the helmet and the metal spikes in there, within hypnosis, you're saying you convince the person those spikes are no longer in there. You're more or less controlling your thoughts. Instead of saying negative thoughts, what we used to do in sales, I come from a sales background, and sometimes we doodle on the phone when we're talking. And my sales manager told me once about you never sell a doodle, write something that's constructive. So we used to work the word I can. So to this day, when I'm on the phone, I always write I can, I can, I can. It's, you know, changing my thought of what I can do. Mm-hmm. Whether I can or can't, whatever you say, it's true. So if I say I can do something, I can do it. So I imagine if somebody comes to you with pain and I've got spikes in my head and this tight helmet on my head, they believe it to be true, therefore it is true. Where in hypnosis you say, well, it's not really true. In fact, you're taking those spikes out of your head, and therefore, okay, I no longer have pain. So is it a question of making the brain or the thought process do something different than it's already doing?
Well, I'd probably differ with you on that. I'm not sure that they literally think there are spikes in their head. But as far as what does this feel like that is a meaningful way for them to conceptualize it. They may have never even thought of it that way until you ask the question. Sometimes I have to be rather directive in pinning somebody down on some really good visual descriptors of their pain. I mean, they say, well, what do you mean? It hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't do a lot with it hurts, you know. So I really push them to exactly what does it feel like? How can you conceptualize it? Quite often give it a color. Sometimes they do that without me asking. Particularly, like if somebody has a burning pain, quite often they'll say it's a red, hot, burning pain. Well, that's another real neat one to deal with because you just slowly change that red hot to a cool, soothing blue. Once again, I don't think that they literally think of it that way. It's just that this is a meaningful way for them to conceptualize it. And then once you have them in trance where you're working with the unconscious self, then, as I said earlier, the unconscious mind will take that literal. Consciously, they don't take it literal.
Okay. What was the turning point where you said to yourself, gosh, hypnosis, this is really cool stuff. I've got to know about this. What was that case that you saw or work that really impressed you?
It was actually through my training programs. Now, I did some hypnosis way back in the 70s when I was in graduate school. But then when I was struggling with my own chronic pain, and I decided I need some training, and incidentally, the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis had contacted our department chair, Peggy Fong, at that time,
mm-hmm.
and said if we would send a professor through their training program for the purposes of creating a course, they would put them through free. So I volunteered to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I went through that, and that was meaningful, but it really didn't give me all I wanted. So I then found some other training programs, one particularly in Silver Springs, Maryland, through the National Board of Certified Clinical Hypnotherapists, that when I went through it, it's like, boy, I didn't realize this was so pragmatic and had so many direct applications to the things I do in practice, particularly things I'm talking about, such as, if somebody has a fear of flying, things of that nature. It's like, yeah, not only does this work, it works 10 times out of 10. I don't have anything else that's that effective. So that's what got me fired up and got me so passionate. And it's, the hypnosis in and of itself. First of all, I can teach you how to do hypnosis in one day. That doesn't have a whole lot of value. The trick isn't doing hypnosis. It's once you have hypnotized somebody, what do you do with them? And the bulk of my class is specific techniques for specific problems.
Once the client is hypnotized.
Yeah, once the client is hypnotized. Now, and, like I have one night, here's a technique. This technique is designed for ongoing emotional reactions to some external trigger, such as phobia. I'll have next night, here's a technique designed for one-time traumatic event, such as people suffering from PTSD. So there are techniques that are very pragmatic for these different issues. And then, as I said earlier, the real passion for me was and continues to be pain management. I have since expanded that. I just finished with a young man with IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. He was a referral, a 15-year-old who was referral from his pediatrician. And there's a template I got from Chapel Hill where they have a large research grant on IBS. And it's an 8-session approach, but it works. And
how old was the client?
He's 15.
Is there a certain age limit? You don't go down below a certain age? Or is it there an IQ test level or something you work with?
The thing that I would emphasize to anybody in hypnotherapy, don't use hypnosis for anything you don't otherwise feel qualified to treat.
Okay.
Now, in my case, I haven't worked extensively with children, and I do get a little out of my comfort zone. When you get, you know, I'm fine with adolescents. When you get down, say an 8-year-old kid, I don't know about this. But that's not because of hypnosis. That's because of me.
So hypnosis is specific for age group, gender issues?
Okay. Children are actually easier to work with because they tend to be more creative.
Well, that was my next question is, can you hypnotize somebody that doesn't want to be hypnotized? And along those lines, do they have to have a certain intellect level? For example, if I'm using a cognitive approach in therapy and the person is not fully functional intellectually, cognitive approach really is not very good. I'd use a behavioral approach, something that they would more relate to. So do I have to have someone with a certain a level of intelligence or a certain level of maturity or development to be hypnotized?
Well, I don't know that you have to have, but it certainly helps. And the literal response to what you actually said a while ago was, can you hypnotize somebody who doesn't want to be hypnotized? Mm-hmm. The thing I would say to you is, ethically, you shouldn't. You shouldn't be trying.
Good answer. I like that.
Okay. If somebody doesn't want to be hypnotized, then use something that they feel comfortable with. And while technically you probably can, and I've seen cases where that was done, it would certainly be difficult to hypnotize somebody who doesn't want to be hypnotized.
And I see now where there's two different questions here. Let's say, for example, you've got to see somebody, a guy comes to you to quit smoking. He says, well, my wife wants me to quit smoking. I probably should, but, you know, I'm only doing this for her. So I'm here. So what would you do? Say, this hypnosis is not for you. You've got to be a willing participant in this and try something else.
Well, the thing that I would emphasize, you cannot get somebody to do something they don't want to do in hypnosis. And that is the real challenge in smoking. And a while ago I said 20%. You can find all kinds of percentages out there on
depends
success
on who's
rate.
Your group, right.
That was one of the real low ones. Probably a little bit better success than 20% on smoking. But the challenge that I find with smokers is exactly what you're talking about. They don't want to quit smoking. Even the ones that they didn't come to you because their wife pushed them. There's a part of them that they want to quit smoking. But I had a fellow who came to me to quit smoking. And one of the things I encourage people to do is, you know, throw away their cigarettes, etc. Got to asking him, you know, do you have any cigarette lighters? Well, yeah, he had three. He had bought them all that week. He had this appointment for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
He's getting ready to come in and see me to quit smoking. He just bought 3 cigarette lighters. this guy wasn't going to quit smoking.
Okay. I'm sure of tying his hands down, which is a whole nother therapy level.
Right. So one of the things that in smoking cessation, and same thing in weight management, that you really have to get somebody nailed down to is making a commitment. Just like in behavioral approaches, a real commitment, get them sign a behavioral contract, whatever it is, that they are going to do this. And you'd be surprised how many won't do that.
Yeah.
Surprise me, people will come to you, pay you good money to do something that everything about them is saying, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, alcohol and drug rehab full of people like that. I've been there for 13 months. I'm still drinking. Well, you've got to want to do it. It's got to be something that the person's got to want to be a participant in the treatment. Yeah. This is something I really want to do. What can you do to help me? Let's go back then to the other question where I was talking to you about intellectual functioning and age groups. How does that fit into hypnosis?
Well, the more intelligent and the more creative the person, the easier it is to hypnotize them. Now, there is a myth out there that not everybody can be hypnotized. Mm-hmm. In reality, anybody can be hypnotized. It's a little more challenging. But the old directive approaches and the ones you're most familiar with, such as looking at a pendulum or staring at a point of light or something, we were actually trained back in the 70s that, you know, a certain percentage of people can't be hypnotized, and another percentage they can be hypnotized only to a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's not true. The problem was the technique. Not everybody can be hypnotized by looking at a watch, you know, or a point of light. The real breakthrough that Milton Erickson provided us was a more, this may be heresy, but it really is a client-centered approach. Erickson didn't use those terms, but his approach is you really get into that person's worldview and you hypnotize them the way that works for them. And you, like in my more recent trained hypnosis, we're trained in what's called BEMERS, Behavioral Manifestations of Internal Responses, of reading subtle cues as to what's going on in that person's internal world and go in with whatever that is.
You still have to tailor your treatment to the person.
That's correct.
Okay. That makes
and
sense,
everybody can be hypnotized. Some people are a little more challenging, and if they don't want to be hypnotized, I'd say, no, don't try. But
so not to be concerned when I talk to you now. I'm okay when I talk to you on the phone.
You're okay.
Okay. I'm okay. I feel okay. That's pretty good. Okay. Well, now I've got a whole lot of things to worry about now. Let me talk just for a second about the professional development of clinical hypnotherapy and hypnosis. The American Counseling Association does not have a division of that represents clinical hypnotherapists. That's correct.
That is correct.
The American Psychological Association does.
That is correct.
Okay. Is there a reason for one having one and one not having association?
I don't think so. I think it's just one of those things, kind of slowly evolving. Hypnosis for a lot of people is still one of those kind of fringes. It has in the last 25. Years or so, become more and more mainstream in therapy. ACA has been a little slow in jumping on that bandwagon. I don't think that it's that they're anti-hypnotherapy or that they have any aversion to it. It's just not something of great popularity.
What does it take? There's no, correct me if I'm wrong, there's no state license to be a hypnotherapist. Is that correct? So
no.
Who can do hypnotherapy?
Well, actually, anybody can do hypnotherapy. I would say they shouldn't. And I really encourage people who go through my training program to become board certified.
How long does that take?
It's not that difficult. You have to have 60 hours of training, and you have to have a license in your profession, and there are some minor things, like you have to have been supervised by someone while you were doing therapy and that sort of thing. Things that you probably are going to have anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not any legal, and as far as I know, no ethical standard that says that you can't go out and do hypnosis right now. That you don't. Whether you've had any training, and that's one of the problems with hypnotherapy, is that literally anybody can hang out a shingle saying, I'm a hypnotherapist. They don't have to have a high school education to do that, kind of like being a sex therapist or something like that. These are generic terms.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that one of the challenges within the profession is professionalizing this and encouraging people that if you are doing this, get the credentials. And I'd say from a liability perspective, you really need all the credentials you can get if you can use hypnotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Hypnosis, like some other techniques, is a more invasive approach. I think that's what makes it highly effective. The other side of that is the more invasive your approach, the more high risk your approach.
Mm-hmm.
You can end up with a lawsuit.
That makes sense there. So you're saying clinical therapy, it's more like one time Body Works was a big thing where they're doing some, I think, hands-on work at one time. And that's, I think, fallen out of favor, but that felt it led up to a lot of lawsuits, and I imagine that clinical therapy, what you're saying is that you're very invasive. You're in contact with this person, therefore you're opening yourself up to more lawsuits there.
Yeah.
So a person, if I'm looking for a therapist, I'm looking for a board-certified hypnotherapist, or
yeah.
what would I look, just board-certified by the...
Well, there are two governing boards. One is the National Board of Certified Clinical Hypnotherapists.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is the American Society of Hypnotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So one of it, what you'd look for credentialing from one of those two governing boards.
Okay. Well, good. Sounds very interesting. One question I ask a lot of people when we finish with the interview on a side note, it's just to learn a little bit about yourself. If you could be any animal, what would it be? Maybe tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm pretty sure I would be a dog. I think dogs are wonderful at training people.
They are, aren't they?
They train people to take care of them and to cater to them, and I just
unconditional positive regard. You go to the mailbox, come back, they're all excited again.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Dwayne Rice, Associate Professor and Director of Counseling Programs at the University of Memphis. This is Dr. Jeffrey Frieden for the audiosource.net.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Dwayne Rice of the University of Memphis regarding the practice of clinical hypnosis.
Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.